Chew Henry Mancini, please. Bum, 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 bum. It's Sunday night, and that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening, this is John McMullen, John Mack the Sun, welcome to the 190th episode of Weekly John Mack Radio Show. The links to recordings of the previous 189 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com, and John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C. That's www.johnmack13.com under the radio show tab. In addition to the previous radio show, you'll also find links to my online daily newspaper at my web home. The newspaper did a curation of news articles from around the country and the world, articles relating to politics, sports, books, the environment, arts, entertainment, opinion, and technology. Try it and subscribe, only one email per day, and it's free. And once again, that's www.johnmack13.com. But I hope you'll join us not only tonight, but every week at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday evenings, live, or as most to listen later. Next week, my guest will be Hamilton Fish, publisher of the New Republic magazine. The nap to this show, the 190th, as I mentioned, callers may call in at any time during this show by dialing 646-716-9756. Once again, that's 646-716-9756. I usually hold callers until near the end of my interview with my guest. My guest tonight has been a frequent participant to this show, John Charles Chick Donahue, co-author with ex-Daily News columnist Joanna Malloy of the just-published The Greatest Beer Run Ever, A True Story of Friendship Stronger Than War. Chick is an inward friend of 65 years, and in our young and more foolish years, we shared many adventures. Since then, he has gone on to many and to more productive adventures. Chick has been a high school dropout, United States Marine, GED diplomate, the Merchant Marine, the bar owner, the Sand Hog, the Harvard MPA, the Teamster official, Sand Hog again, and is now retired in Florida, New York, and Ireland. Good evening, Chick. So welcome back to the show.
Good evening, John. Happy Mother's Day.
Happy Mother's Day to you, Chick. Let's start right at the beginning of this story. What led to this odyssey?
Well, if you're from Inwood, you know about George Lynch, the bartender, the colonel, as we called him. I walked through a demonstration in Central Park. They were demonstrating against the war. It was in November of 67, and I was very upset with it. And I went up to Inwood and went in to see the colonel. He had seen it on TV. He was very upset with it. And a discussion ensued about what we can do about it. We got to do something. Well, we couldn't attack the demonstrators as much as we wanted to at the time. So Lynch asked for my Siemens papers. He said, somebody's got to go over there and tell all the guys from the neighborhood that we were behind him. Well, that was impossible, so I agreed to go. I asked Lynch to get the names and the unit numbers from the guys. And the next day or two, I forget exactly, it was 1 or 2 days. It didn't take much longer. I went down to Union Hall, and I found a ship, the Drake Victory, an old World War II refurbished ship, Commander Mothball. And it was taking ammunition to Vietnam, so I got on that ship and went to Vietnam.
Oh,
that's how I thought it.
That wasn't new to George, by the way. We always thought of him as a super patriot then, but I remember when the Pueblo was captured, he showed me this telegram in Vietnam that he had sent to Lyndon Johnson, President Lyndon Johnson. I'm standing ready, willing, and able to serve wherever you need me, so I'm George E. Lynch III. Now, of course, I don't think George ever got higher than the private in the army, but he was ready to go.
With all due respect, he made PFC.
Oh, PFC. Okay. How long did it take you to get to Vietnam?
Well, it took me 2 months. It took me just about 2 months. The ship went out, you know, down through the Panama Canal. Took about a month to do that. And then actually 31 days from the Pacific side of the Panama Canal to get to Quy Nhon in South Vietnam. And I went looking right away. The first guy I found was Tommy Collins. Even before I got to shore, he was on MP on guard duty on another ship in the harbor. And I found him.
Hadn't his mother spoken to you before you?
Well, when I told George I needed the unit addresses, the next night I came back to the bar. It was docks, and Mrs. Collins was there. You know, she was a lovely lady, Irish woman with a nice brogue. And told me, "Chickie, oh, you got to go and see my Tommy, and thank God you're going to see him. Tell him I love him and I pray for him every day, a good shepherd." So, coincidentally, he was the first guy I found.
And speaking of Tommy Collins, he joined us now on the John Mack Hotline. Tom, do you remember your first reaction to this vision in a Madras shirt?
Well, John, when I actually saw him and recognized him, I couldn't believe it. First, I think my first words out of my mouth was, "What the hell are you doing here?" And ultimately.
Go ahead.
So, but what happened is at that particular time, myself and another MP, I was assigned to the 127th MP Company in Quy Nhon, South Vietnam. Our mission over there basically was road patrol, town patrol, POW camps, and the harbor. At that particular time, I was assigned to the ship at the harbor or whatever have you. And I was just coming off the ship to be replaced by two other MPs. And at which time I looked over the side and I saw John. It was amazing. It was like a breath of fresh air seeing somebody that from the States that actually came over to say hello to us.
And how did you pass the time away with him before he had to leave and you had to go back to duty?
Well, when I came off the ship, I went on to a tender and we went back towards the area into Quy Nhon. And we started to have a couple of beers. In fact, I think we had more than a few beers. And that night, Chick and I stayed up pretty late. And the following morning, he left and he went on to another road up towards our friend up in Phu Bai area, Ricky Dugan.
And Chick, what was the next thing on your itinerary?
Well, after I saw Tommy, Dugan was next. So I got a ride in a first cab airplane, and the first cab was stationed up in An Ke at that time. And I flew up there, and then I found Dugan's company, and the supply sergeant told me that they had gone up north early that morning. And I gave him this story that he was my stepbrother and mom died and pop, pop, pop. And I promised her before she died I'd go and find him. Dot, dot, dot. So I asked the guy, he said, "You can write him a letter and he'll get it this afternoon." So I asked him, "You don't even know where he is, you said, just up north. But if I write a letter, you'll get it to him this afternoon." He says, "Yeah." He says, "We got a 1,300 mail run going north. Like, don't you know that?" So I look at this guy and I said, "Well, is there any chance I can get on that mail run?" And he looked at me and said, like, "Hey, dummy, you got here, didn't you?" So I went down to the airfield, and on my way to the airfield, it was a couple of miles away, and I had to go through this jungle. It was a nice wide dirt road. But there was nothing on that dirt road, no trucks, no vehicles, no buildings, no nothing. So I'm humping it down there. It's getting close to one. So I'm practically running down the road, and then I see a dust thing coming down. A Jeep was coming back down the road, heading towards the airport. So I flagged the guy down, and I said, he says, where are you running to? I said, the airport. So he says, jump in. So I jumped in the back, and we kept going down, and he says, what are you doing out here? I said, well, I'm from New York, and I'm looking for some buddies of mine. I promised them I'd bring them some beer, and you know, to cheer them up and let them know that the guys back home support them, blah, 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 blah. The guy stopped the Jeep, and he says, holy smoke, Chicky, what the heck are you? What are you, crazy? And it was Kevin McClune. And Kevin was one of the guys on the list that Lynch had given me. So I got two guys, and it was like 2 days I saw two guys. So
And now Kevin McClune joins us on the John Mack Hotline. Kevin, what was your reaction when you found Chicky in the Jeep?
I couldn't believe him. First of all, I couldn't believe the shirt he was wearing. And, I mean, he just looked totally out of place in the Central Highlands. And I was going into town, into the town of Anquet with two friends of mine. And we were civilians. I had been there in the Marine Corps in 1963 and 64. I was in a helicopter squadron. And I went back over as a civilian. And we were working up in Camp Radcliffe and up in Anquet. And we were heading into the ville, so they said. And I picked, once I heard that voice, I said, holy Christ, it's Chicky Donahue. So that was amazing. I was flattened.
Kevin, I understand you're not from God's country to begin with. How'd you happen to know Chick?
I knew him from Long Beach. I was born and raised in Long Beach. And, he and I had some mutual friends, and Chick used to come down to Long Beach in the summer. And ironically, after I stayed there another 2 years after I met Chick, but when I came back, half of Inwood had moved to Long Beach. So, that's how I knew him. I knew him from Long Beach.
Moving right along, what happened next, Chick?
Well, I got to the airfield, and by this time I noticed a couple of things that the people who were talking to me, the officers and, the authorities, they were talking to me. They'd say, who are you with? What are you doing, So I'd say, I'm a civilian, and I'm coming from down south, and I'm trying to get up north. So they took that as I was some sort of civilian employee of the government, some sort of agent or something. And I didn't try to pitch my way that way, but I knew if I told them I was a seaman on this crazy mission that I wouldn't get past them. So they kept treating me with deference like I was somebody important, sort of. So I said, I got to get on that 1300 mail run up north. And the guy says, let me see here and that. So I just said, listen, I got to get on. It's going off in a minute. I don't have time to hang around here. So he says, all right, get on. So I got on and took me up there. And when I got off, I followed these two GIs who were on the plane who come back from hospital. And they got into a PC. And I stopped the PC just before it took off, and I jumped in the back with them, and I gave two bangs on the side of the PC, and the guy kept driving, and he took me through the hills to a place called LZ Tombstone, where there was a dozen or so helicopters lined up. And I followed those two guys because they were in the same company as Dugan, Ricky Dugan, who was next on my list. And they went into a tent, and I came out of the tent, and they said, we got a chopper going up there on LZ Jane, and we're leaving at 1800, 6 o'clock. By that time, it was a little after 5. So I went in, and I pulled the same routine to this kid in the tent. I said, listen, my name is Donahue. You want to put me on that chopper going up to LZ Jane at 1800? He says, are you a civilian, sir? I still was wearing dungarees and this shirt. And I had kind of long hair and a struggling beard. And I said, yeah, I'm a civilian. Like, that's important, I didn't say that, but he says, well, you're going to have to talk to Major Meeker or someone, whatever his name was. So with that, Major Meeker just walked into the tent. What's going on here? So he says, this man wants to go up to LZ Jane. He says, who are you? So I told him, my name is John Donahue. I'm a civilian. I'm coming from down south. And I realized when I said down south, everybody thought I was talking like Saigon. Nobody comes from up north in that country. They were all coming from down south. And he says, what are you going up there for? I said, well, I'll tell you the truth, Major. I can't tell you, but if I did tell you, you wouldn't believe me anyway. Well, now the guy for sure thought I was some sort of agent. He says, you guys are all alike. You don't let nothing out. Come on, did you have dinner? Put his name down, he said. Come on, we'll have dinner. So he fed me something in the officer's tent there, and I got a great kick out of that. And at 1800, I got in a helicopter and flew up to LZ Jane. And I got off, and they called Dugan in from an ambush outside. He was in an ambush spot or whatever they call it. And I had to wait, and they hid me in a little hole in a hooch, they called it. It was like a dugout. And they put a tarpon over me. And when Dugan came in, he said, what do you want me for? You know, it's getting dark. I got to get back out there. They were in ambush. And the guy says, I don't want you. This guy does. And he pulled the tarpon off, and hey, Ricky, I said. Dugan looked at me, and he said, holy my God, Chicky. What the hell are you doing here? He says, who are you with? I said, I'm with you. Who am I with? I'm in this hole by myself. And so the sergeant said, I know he's not supposed to be here. I can't answer for him. So you better take him with you. He says, Sarge, I'm out in an ambush. He says, I don't care. Don't leave him here. And we were in new territory. I hadn't been there 24 hours. So I went out to the ambush with Dugan.
And while with Ricky, you've got to see more combat action than you would ever seen in the Marine Corps. Tell us about that.
I saw more what?
More action, more people firing weapons in anger.
Yeah. I saw. I got myself into some dangerous spots. The first was with Dugan in his ambush site, and that night the enemy came and it was firing and whatever, back and forth, and I'll never forget, they handed me a weapon, a grenade launcher, and the guys, there was about a dozen or two dozen guys out there, and we were, I think you said, 500 meters from our lines, and he said, listen, if we get overrun, that's where our lines are, right over there, you boogie over that way, and we'll be okay. I said, holy crap, I didn't buy for this, I didn't jump in for this stuff, I come over, say hello, buy you a beer. But we got through the night. There was some firing. Nobody overran us. They came up close, but they didn't overrun us. And then the next morning, I went in with them. And then they went out again the next night, and there was more firing. But I stayed back. I didn't go out the next night where there was some firing and there was some killing and whatever. But I ran into a number of dangerous spots over there, and by the time, a couple of days later, I realized I stepped into something I did not bargain for. I mean, just to get back, I got caught out in a road in nighttime that was in the enemy territory on a road from Phucat to Quinon, and then I got caught in the presidential palace. I got caught, and I went up to Long Bend to see Bobby Pappas. And I spent a couple of days with him, and then when I came back to Saigon, I sat up in a Caraville Hotel, a bar on the roof.
You're way ahead of us, Dick. Okay. Now, Bob Pappas joins us on the hotline. What did you think, Bob, when Chicky showed up?
I had known that. The morning that he came to see me, I had received a letter from his girlfriend, Mary, who at the time, and had told me that he had jumped ship overseas. And I was in stationed in Long Bend Ammunition Depot at the Security Operations Center. I was a security sergeant and the chief radio operator in charge of communications there. And the area that we were in, you couldn't get in there without an armed escort. And there were no civilians allowed in there whatsoever. And when he came marching into the CP, with I worked for a captain called Captain Tiffany, and he was a devout Mormon, a very religious man, and very straight-laced. Chickie come marching through the door and cursing and, you know, talking like guys talk, you know, when they see each other and they haven't seen each other in a long time. And I thought the guy was going to have a heart attack. But it was great to see him. I was totally shocked. You know, I had read the letter from Mary that morning, and I was a little annoyed that he hadn't come to see me, you know, and here he is walking through the door. So it was a complete shock to me. We had just the day before we'd been overrun, and we had just cleared out the enemy forces that were inside the ammunition depot. So how the hell he got in there was a big mystery to my boss. And then what he told my captain, commanding officer, was that he told the guy that brought him in. We had six Roman patrols. One of the Roman patrols brought him in a jeep. Excuse me. And he told him that he was my stepbrother. And the guy said, well, tell me a story about Bobby Pappas. And he told him a story about the bar we hung out. And he says, you sound crazy enough to be his brother, you know. The guy brought him in, and it was nice. You know, we spent a couple of days together. I got some guys to cover for me. Excuse me. And we went to the officers club. We did some drinking. I got him some change of clothes. He was wearing some stuff that looked like it hadn't been washed in a week. And so I got him some, I got him a set of my fatigues, and I had the laundry girl slow a civilian thing on it, a civilian patch where the name patch usually went. So it was really good to see him. I mean, it really, we had just, I think that I hadn't slept maybe in 2 days. We had been under a heavy attack. This is right during the middle of the Tet Offensive in 1968. And, it was good to have some of that stress and tension taken away from me, you know, for a couple of hours and stuff. So I was really grateful he was there.
Speaking of the Tet events, Chick, the Viet Cong interfered with the rest of your plans. How did that happen? You went to Saigon, and then what happened?
Well, after I got left Dugan, as a matter of fact, and I got back down to where my ship was in Quinon, it had sailed. So, and I had no passport, I had no visa, I just had a merchant seaman ID card, which was good enough to get on an American ship, but it wasn't good enough to get out of Vietnam. So I had to get to Saigon. So I went back to my routine, and I went out to the airport, and I hung around towards the end of the runway where the pilots go in and turn in their paperwork before they take off, and I kept asking them, anybody going down to Saigon? Anybody going down to Saigon? So some guy who turned out to be a warrant officer, but more important, he had been a merchant seaman during World War II. He asked me what I was doing. By that time, I'd been a few days living in my clothes, and I was a cruddy, cruddy mess. And I told him I went up to see my stepbrother up north, and pop, 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 and I can pack my ship is gone, and I'm trying to get to another ship or catch that ship in Saigon. So I'll never forget what he told me. He says, all right, hang out here. I'm getting on that plane right there. If I give you the wave, jump on that plane, get in the back two seats, and I'll take you to Saigon. And that's exactly what happened. And he came back, and he yelled in my ear because of all the noise after the plane took off. He said, you're lucky I was a merchant seaman in World War II. Otherwise, I would have left your cruddy butt back there in Quinon. He says, but you got to do me a favor when you get to Saigon. I said, sure, whatever you want. He says, take a bath. That's all he told me. So I got to Saigon, went to the embassy, told them my story. They started the bureaucracy going. It took a number of days to get the bureaucracy going, to get a passport, to get a visa. And then they said, all right, we got a ship here in Manila. They'll pick you up. You'll be here tomorrow morning. We got a flight out of Tanzanert at 10 o'clock. You get here about 7:30, 8 o'clock, and we'll get you out to Tanzanert, the airfield there, and we'll fly you to Manila so you can join an American ship. Great. So that night, it was New Year's Eve. I went out with a friend of mine, another seaman who I met in the port there. And I come back that night. I went to the embassy at like 7 o'clock in the morning to make that 9 or 10 o'clock flight. And the embassy was under attack. As a matter of fact, Charlie was inside the embassy. And it was just crazy. The whole town was blown apart. And I just couldn't accept the fact that the American embassy was being occupied by the Viet Cong. And there was all sorts of firing. It was just absolutely crazy. I know that there was a tip-off that there would be an attack. So the embassy was reinforced by, they told me, I found out later, 5 new guys to protect it, 3 Marines and 2 more MPs. And out of them 5 guys, 3 of them were killed in that battle. There was 19 Viet Cong killed. There was a bunch of people wounded. There was a couple of civilians killed. I think they were French citizens. And so I wound up the whole morning there. And when I finally got out of there, I was going to the Palace Hotel on Tudor Street. And 2 CIA guys were coming out, and they were getting into a Jeep. And I said, are you going to the palace? They said, yeah. I said, I need to get over there. Sure. So they handed me a weapon and got in their Jeep. It was the only vehicle moving. And we flew down the road, and we passed Tudor Street. And my father asked, where are you going? I'm going to the palace. It's right around the corner here. And he drove around the corner. And with that, at the other end of the block, we were now across the street from the presidential palace. And down the end of the block, a rocket hit another Jeep, the only other vehicle I saw that day, and blew it up. And these guys just jumped out of the Jeep. They never put the brakes on or nothing. So I finally got out of that Jeep and spent the next rest of the day and night undercover there. There was firing back and forth from in a building that I was hiding under the wall in front of a building under construction. And the bad guys were in there, and they were firing, of course. Anyway, I was scared crapless, as you can imagine. And I spent the day there and the next night, but I didn't know anybody. Nobody knew me. Earlier, I had stopped the GI, and nobody wanted anything to do with me. Not that there were people in the streets. Nobody was out. This guy was in a bunker type thing. But anyway, I was all by myself. And so during that night, it was dark. I was under a stairway. And I actually thought I might have been killed the day before. And I thought that because I couldn't call anybody. I couldn't go anywhere. There was no thing to protect me. The military didn't want anything to do with me. They had everything to do just to protect themselves. And I said, you know, I probably got shot, and I'm dead, and I'm in purgatory. And this is what purgatory was. But the next day, in the daylight, I waited a couple hours of daylight, and I come out, and I started heading towards the waterfront. Again, nobody in the streets, but I ran into another seaman who I had known, and I realized, oh, God. He said, hey, Chicky, what are you doing? I said, oh, I'm alive. Great. This is going to be fun, hopefully. So I wound up a few more weeks there, and that's when I went up to see Bobby. When I finally found where Bobby's outfit was, I went up to see Bobby, and after I spent a day or two with Bobby and went back down to Saigon, I'm sitting up in that barroom, the bar on top of the Caravelle Hotel, and the whole night, the whole sky blew up. And I said, oh, my God, what the heck is that? And some guy in authority said, it's the ammo dump at Long Bin. It's the only thing that could make that much conflagration or whatever. And that was the ammo dump I left Bobby in earlier that morning or that afternoon. So So the next morning, I got in the convoy and went back up to Long Bin and went back to the ammo dump and got back to the bunker that he was in the command post. And I walked in there and thinking he was dead. The place was blown to smithereens. I thought the guy was dead. I was even planning on taking his body home. Maybe they'd let me come home with the body or something. And when I walked in, he says to me, "You this and that, you this and that. You told me this effing war was over. Look at this place. Does it look like this effing war is over?" And then I realized there was nothing wrong with Bobby Pappas. He was pissed off at me. Well, that was great. He was alive. He was in a lot better shape than I ever thought I'd find him. So I spent another day with him, then went back to Saigon. And finally, one of the seamen on one of the ships, the ship got hit with a rocket, and it wounded a oiler. And I got that guy's job, the union rules, and I was always a union guy, and I knew the rules, that they couldn't sail short. The ship couldn't sail short. So when they took the wounded oiler off the ship, the American ship, it was the SS Lehman, the United Fruit ship, he was not going to come back to that ship. And the captain wanted to sail short, but the union chairman of the ship, who I knew, convinced them, "You can't do it. Contract says you got to hire this guy." So they hired me. I finally got a job, and a few weeks later, I don't know how many weeks, three maybe, I wound up in Seattle, Washington, and still had the same clothes. Went to JCPenney, took them all off, put on new clothes, and flew back to Inwood.
Tom, what was Tet like to your unit? Were you in the middle of any of this combat?
What ended up happening is shortly after Chickie had left and we got him out to the airport at strip area, we got somebody take him out. What ended up happening is our town was overran. Queen Anne was overran. So they brought not only ours, but also the rock soldiers back in to turn around and try to take back the town or whatever have you. And it was busy at that time.
Kevin, how about you? Dude, here is this civilian. Did you get hit? And Ted at all?
Yeah,
what happened?
Well, when I left on K, I was working for an outfit called Don Electron, and there was a team of us, about 10 guys. And we went to a place called Chulai, and Chulai was where the Americal division was. And for about a month there. Well, actually, Tet went on for months and months and months. I think they had like three or four stages of it. But there was a big increase in mortar attacks, rocket attacks. It picked up some, you know. Made me nervous. I'll tell you. We were there to put scrambler systems in the Army helicopters for the FM radio sets, so the enemy couldn't pick them up. And we went from one end of the country to the other. You know, like I said, I was there for about another 2 years almost.
I had Ed, speaking of helicopters, I had Ed Hagen on the show a while back. He was an intelligence officer there for 2 years, and his helicopter got shot down. And while he was there, the pilot got killed, and it was he was riding it. He came back very disillusioned with the war and everything. Tom, how much longer did you have in Vietnam after Chickie went away?
Shortly after the Tet Offensive hit and everything else like that, I was brought down into Queen Anne, into Cameron Bay to go back to the world, actually, at that time. My tour was up. I came back into the United States, and I actually physically got out of the service on February 29th, 1968.
What did you do after you left the service?
John, I ended up going to the New York City Police Department. Spent 13 years in the 32nd Precinct on 135th Street and between 7th and 8th Avenue, and then I went into a detective division.
I come from a long line of NYPD. My grandfather, my father, my godfather. So, what about you? What about you, Kevin? How much longer? Oh, you said you're over there for two more years.
I came back to give my sister away. She was getting married in the it was the end of 69. And after I came home, I got into Local One, elevator constructors, and I spent close to 40 years as an elevator constructor after that.
Okay. And Bob, what about
you? Yeah, I retired. I'm down in Florida, and part-time in Florida, part-time up north.
Okay. And, Bob, what about you? How much longer were you over there? What did you do when you came home?
I stayed there until October of 68. Came home. I worked on Wall Street for a couple of years, and I was a lather in construction. And then in 1976, I took a job at the Long Island Lighting Company, and I was with them for 23 years. I retired at age 54, and they called me back as a consultant. I worked up until about, on a part-time basis, up until about 2 years ago. And since then, I've moved down to South Carolina, just a little bit south of Myrtle Beach, a place called Merle's Inlet, and I've been living here, doing very well. It's good to be in one piece, you know, to get back in one piece.
Sure. We had a place in Hilton Head for about 10 years. That's beautiful country down there, that whole area.
Yeah, the beaches are, you know, kind of similar to what I was used to on Long Island. Plenty of golf, you know, weather's nicer, and not too much snow. So I'm glad to be here.
Chick, how long were you in, from the time you got to Vietnam, how long were you there before you got on the boat?
Before I got back?
Or before you got on the ship to get out, how long were you actually in Vietnam?
Oh, I think I got on that ship just before St. Patrick's Day, maybe the first week in March. I know I was out at sea in for St. Patrick's Day. I was only a couple of days at sea, I believe. And then went to Seattle. That was at least 14 day or three weeks crossing. And then I went back to New York. And from there I went back, you know, I went back to the ships.
How long was the whole odyssey from the time that you left until you got home?
Well, if I got, say, back the beginning of April, end of March, beginning of April, I started out in the beginning and or middle of November.
Okay.
So.
I know that when you went that you were fueled by not only your own feeling on the protesters, but the super patriotism of George Lynch. But your views changed a little based on your experience and your later life. How so?
Well, as you know, in those days, I was very angry at I can't even mention that actress's name. And I'm still angry at that actress. But there were a lot of Americans and actually some veterans, some Vietnam veterans that were demonstrating against the war to end the war and end the war. And that I was upset in the beginning as I saw the war and I saw the results of the war. I wish it had never happened. And we're still paying for it, maybe not in dollars and cents, but in men and women's and families' lives. What can I tell you?
One of the tragedies of Vietnam was that as opinion went against the war, the vets were treated by many as they're responsible for the policy. They only did what U.S. servicemen have always done, what they were instructed to do. Thankfully, we have not treated Iraq vets like that. Tom, how do you see the war in retrospect?
Well, in today's world, actually, that we live in, I can see where the respect is given so much more now to the veterans of Afghanistan and Iraq, and I really applaud the people for what they are. you can hate your war, but you should love your warrior.
Beautiful.
And how do you see the war now that you look back on it? Is it something that we should have been there, or did you wind up like Chick being being negative on it, but you probably weren't while you were there? Did your opinion change at all?
Well, you know, when you're over there when you go over there, you're young, you're naive and everything else like that, and you don't think anything can hurt you or whatever have you. But when you see through the eyes of the veterans coming home and what they went through and the disgust that our nation left us, and when we walked back through the gates, even into New York and everything else like that, there was protesters mocking us and everything else like that. And even when you come back into the city where you grew up and everything else like that, basically you were alone, because most of us came home by ourselves and drifted back into the society, I guess, and you were supposed to act normal, which doesn't happen.
Kevin, what about you?
You know, it's funny. If you ever been to the memorial, the Vietnam Memorial, it's pretty gripping. And you realize 58,000 dead, God knows how many maimed for life. And to be honest with you, I wouldn't even venture a guess. You know, I salute every single individual who was over there, and proud of every man that served over there. But I don't know what for. It was a tragedy. That's how I feel about it.
Bobby?
Well, you know, I was brought up by my parents to believe in God and country, you know. So when it came for my time to serve, I was only married 30 days when I went into service. I had to get a 30-day deferment so I could get married. I had plans and everything. So I wasn't really too pleased about going into the service, but I felt it was my duty. And coming back, you know, the way we were treated when we came back, it kind of I isolated myself from other veterans, because I didn't want to deal with what went on over there. And for years and years, I had a good friend for 22 years and never knew I was in Vietnam, you know. So I look back at it today, I don't think, and I look at what's going on in the world today, I just cannot understand why we have to live like this, you know, that you would think after all these years and years as civilization has grown that we would come to our senses and try to figure out our differences and stuff. But I guess that's never going to happen, you know, as much as a lot of us pray for that when we say our prayers and stuff. I'm not ashamed of the fact that I served there today. I can talk about it today. I still have some PTSD issues that I just started going back to counseling for this past week. But if I had to do it all over again, strangely enough, I probably would, you know. So I'm just I'm proud to be a vet, and I'm proud that I did my duty, and I'm proud to associate with these other guys that are on the show today. So that's where I'm at with it.
Thank you, Wolf, for your service. Chick, you went on with your life. Sandhog, Harvard, with some of your later adventures written about by Deluxe, the Mike McAlary in the Daily News, and Dennis Duggan in Newsday. How did this book project get started?
Well, I tried to write it myself years ago. I couldn't do it. But Joanna Malloy, who was a reporter for many, many years at the Daily News, came to me at the direction of Steve McFadden. Steve and her were close, and Steve called me and asked me if he could give my number to Joanne. She wanted to write about the Vietnam story as it pertained to my trip. So I took the call, and she said, I want to write about it. Will you cooperate with me? I said, yeah, I'll cooperate with you. So that's how it started. And all I wanted out of it was it to be accurate. Because you realize this November it'll be 50 years since I went down to the Union Hall to get on a ship. And in the beginning I would tell a story and some of my best friends would say, that's just bull. That can't be. So, and you know, that was aggravating. And but it was everybody, my friends, even some members of my family. So I stopped telling the story. But then when she said that, I said, listen, she says, well, will you call these guys and talk to these guys? I said, no. I said, I won't. I said, you call them and you talk to them. Because I don't want anybody to say that I made this story up and got my friends to back it up, you know. So she did. And they began to talk. It's taken a couple of years to get it all down. And a number of them have written in the book. And by the way, there's a book out. Known as the name, the title is The Greatest Beer Run Ever. You can get it at your local bookstore by asking them to get it in from Ingram Spark. Or you can go right to Amazon and buy it on Amazon.
Chick, I'm going to talk about all that. You're way ahead of me. You're way ahead of me again. I saw the filming of the video about this at the Kingsbridge Pipers Guild with you and Tom. How did that get arranged?
That got arranged with a neighbor of Joanna, a young man by the name of Andrew, who worked for Bobby Valentine. Remember, he has a documentary company, and Andrew worked for him, and Andrew produced it, directed it, whatever, Andrew Muscata. And he asked if I'd like to get all you and your buddies together, learning of the story from Joanna. So I said, yeah. So I was envisioning, you know, bringing all the guys down to Florida in the wintertime, putting them up in a big resort and everything. So he had no such ideas. So we did it in the Pipers Kilt in 231st Street. Doc Fiddlers was gone by then. Chambers was gone by then, so we went to the Pipers Kilt. They call it the kilt or whatever now. And that was 3 years ago, I believe. And or 2 years ago, a couple of years. And they put it out, and we hoped that it would expedite the book, getting the book done, and it'll all be released at the same time, but it didn't work out that way. But the book is out, and it's available.
And the video is all over YouTube, and it's been watched by thousands of people. And when I put an article out, I'll give you the URL. Oh, we have a caller on from the 7007 area code. What do I have on the phone? Caller from the 7007.
Hi. You have Bunny.
Bunny, do you... Chick, do you know Bunny?
Oh, my sister. My sister, Bunny.
Happy
Mother's Day, honey.
Happy Mother's Day,
Bunny. Happy Mother's Day. Where are you? In Mexico or America?
I am. But I love hearing your voice. So John was kind enough to let me know ahead of time. So
did you know all about this insanity, Bunny, the whole story? Or?
No, I was young. I was too young. All I knew was my brothers and sisters would take care of me when my mother and father were working all day, and Chicky was the most fun one to be hanging out with. I liked it when it was his turn.
I heard a story that when Chicky used to push you and your sister in baby carriages, that he would actually take money from neighborhood kids to take his place, like the Tom Sawyer story about painting. Is that true, Bunny?
I don't know. That would have been Christine, and she was older than I was. So, John, I was the baby.
Chick, was that true?
I was really young. Huh?
Chick,
happened.
Was that true, Chick?
Okay. Chick will be signing books at at the monthly luncheon of the Narrowbacks this Thursday, May 18th at 12 noon at the Heritage, 960 McLean Avenue, in Yonkers. The phone number is 914-776-7532. That's 914-776-7532. That's the Heritage on McLean Avenue. He will also be signing books the following evening, Friday, at the American Legion Hall on the same McLean Avenue, 840 McLean Avenue, Yonkers, New York. What time does it begin on Friday, Chick?
I think it's 6 o'clock. They have their meeting there, and I think the meeting is scheduled for 6, so it's immediately after the meeting.
And the phone number there is 914-237-9311. That's 914-237-9311. What other dates have you lined up to talk, sign, and sales, Chip?
Well, June 19th at the Irish American Historical Society on Fifth Avenue. Again, at 6 o'clock. There's going to be a reading and a reception there. I'm going to address my own union, the Sandhogs, of which I'm retired from, on Sunday, next Sunday, May 20th, at the Teamsters Hall on 14th Street. That's all I have right now.
The book is, as Chick mentioned, it's available on Amazon in hardcover, softcover, and Kindle formats at very reasonable prices. I would have charged more. Go to Amazon and do the search on Chick Donahue, and Donahue is D-O-N-O-H-U-E. We've covered a lot of ground tonight. What else would you like the audience to know about this story? I'll start with Kevin. Is there anything else you'd like to say, Kevin?
Well, I'm looking forward to meeting with Bobby Pappas, because I was a good friend of his brother Billy, and I wasn't there when they made the video. I was incapacitated. I had a bunch of medical problems, but I think it's great of you to have Chick and us on the show and pushing the book. And I'm proud of these guys, all of them.
Tom, how about you?
First, John, I want to thank you very much for giving us the airtime and giving Chick the really the dues that he's actually earned over and over. Chicky is, like, to me, like an unsung hero. He came when he didn't have to, and he really was a big inspiration for both myself, and I'm sure I can speak for Ricky, for Kevin, and for Bobby. It was a breath of fresh air seeing somebody like that come to our door, basically, if you want to call it that. But again, I wish each and every one of you health and happiness throughout your lives.
Tom, by the way, grew up across the street from me on Seaman Avenue, but he was one of the little kids, and I only knew his older brother and his older sister. Bob, what about you? Is there anything else you want to add to tonight?
Well, I'm just grateful, you know, that this came out. I know there was a big to-do on the Inwood board about there were a lot of non-believers to the story, you know. It's a pretty cool story. It's, you know, it's a thing about true friendship. So I'm glad it happened. I'm glad that Joanna took the time to write the book. I just think it's a terrific thing that he did. And it's nice to show that Inwood camaraderie to the rest of the world, you know. So hopefully the book will be a seller. And it's a pretty good read, I think. That's all I got. Thanks again, guys.
I agree. It's a good read, because, and the one thing that is extremely impressive to me is that Joanna, who actually did the writing from Chick narrating, she really captured Chick's voice. If you read it, you get the impression that he's talking. That's not like Mickey Mantle as told to someone. This is extremely well done, I think. Chick, what about you? Do you want to add anything?
No, I just, you know, I always thought somebody would think that I did this to write a book or to get famous or noted for it. Well, if I did, I waited almost 50 years to write the book and to get noted. I'm still not famous, and I don't want to need to be famous. I'm quite happy. I'm a retired sand hog living in Florida. And this summer, I'm going to spend some time with my grandchildren and my daughter in Ireland. And that's a dream come true.
Chick never had to, he never had to do anything to, that was crazy to be famous. Chick did things that were crazy just to be crazy. One of the things that comes to mind, I remember we were sitting halfway up the path behind the flagpole drinking beer, and Chickie got Artie Burns and Frank Mulderig and I to go up to Visitation, which was the dance. He kept saying, let's go up there. I met a girl. Let's go up there. Let's go up there. Let's go. So finally, we jump in a cab. We go up there. As it turned out, the three guys from Inwood won the dance contest. Everyone was screaming, yeah, Good Shepherd, Inwood. And the fight broke out. It spilled out into the street. It was a big brawl. The police came. Everyone dispersed. The way Chickie dispersed, he decided that they might come looking for him. So he hitchhiked to Canada. And when he got to Toronto, he found himself with no money and with no way to get home. So this was a typical Donahue adventure that I spent many years going through things like this. Right, Chick?
Yeah. Fairly accurate there, Johnny. But I got home. I went to the local parish, told the priest. My mother told me when I got in trouble, come to you, and you're going to help me out. And they did.
Before we go off, we have one more call. Who's calling from the 845 number?
This is Lou Farragher, Jr.
Hello, Lou Farragher, Jr.
Hey, hey guys, how are you? Listen, I've been listening to the show. Hey, Uncle Chick, how are you, brother? I've been listening to the show and absolutely love it. And just thinking about, you know, you guys talking about what was going on in Vietnam, and even though I was born in 68, is, you know, you guys, that's an old school, how you guys lived your life, and the government asked you to do a job, so never be embarrassed of what you did. And as a young man, I am very proud of you guys, and you should have been welcomed back like every other war hero that that came back. So, just from my perspective, I my dad was a stand-up guy, and my Uncle Chick, a stand-up guy, and I just have the utmost respect for you guys. And John, I love what you're doing with this show. I love the story. And I appreciate you guys.
Thanks, Lou.
Thanks, Lou.
Hey, no problem, guys. And God bless. And happy Mother's Day to all the mothers out there. And you guys be well.
Lou, give your regards. Give my regards to your mother. She lived next door to me and diagonally across the street from Tom Collins and the and her doctor. John Musea is an old friend of Chick and mine.
That's great to hear. And this is I like to hear some of the I love listening to the stories you guys have. And like I said, they don't make guys like you guys today. You know, I try to live that stand up lifestyle you guys did. And like I said, God bless, and I love the stories. So thank you so much. And thank you for everything you guys did.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
All right. And thank you, Chick, Tom, Kevin, Bob. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you very much.
John, thank you very much for having us.
Yeah, thanks a lot, John. Pleasure talking to you.
Thank you.
A bit of commercial information. My books are available. I like Chick's. At Amazon, and I've blogged themedium.com and published the Daily Paper I mentioned above. Send comments to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. And in the words of Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, after the Mets win, put it in a book. And we'll go off with a New York thing, if I can get the control room to bring it up. It's something you may all remember when we were young. In the morning, I'm on the children's hour on Sunday morning, the sidewalks of New York. Good night, everybody.
Good night, John.
Well done.
So this guy,
West Side, all around the town. Those and bridges falling down, boys and girls together, me and Pammy Rock, fantastic on the sidewalks of by the dead end on 27th Street. Thank you.